happened to Fanny's sister, Granny?"
I hesitated, looking down at him. He was only 9, and surely it was his parents' place to tell him what they thought he should know. But Fanny was his friend, and God knew she needed a friend she could trust. "Come down with me," I said, turning him toward the stair with a hand on his shoulder. "I'll tell you while I make more tea, and don't bloody tell your mother I did." I told him as simply as I could, and omitting the things Fanny had told me about the late Captain Harkness's habits. "Do you know the word whore, whore, I mean," I amended, and the frown of incomprehension relaxed.
"Sure, Germain told me. Whores are ladies that go to bed with men they aren't married to. Fanny's not a whore, though. Who's her sister?"
He looked troubled at the thought. "Well, yes," I said, "not to put too fine a point on it, but women or girls who become whores do it because they have no other way to earn a living, not because they want to, I mean." He looked confused.
"How do they earn money?"
"Oh, the men pay them to, go to bed with them." "Take my word for it," I assured him, seeing his eyes widen in astonishment.
"I go to bed with Mandy and Fanny all the time," he protested, "and Germain too. I wouldn't pay them money for being girls."
"Jeremiah," I said, pouring fresh hot water into the pot. "Go to bed is a euphemism. Do you know that word? It means saying something that sounds better than what you're really talking about. For sexual intercourse."
"Oh, that," he said, his face clearing.
"Like the pigs? Or the chickens?" "Rather like that, yes. Find me a clean cloth, will you? There should be some in the lower cupboard." I knelt, knees creaking slightly, and scooped the hot stone out of the ashes with the poker. It made a small hissing sound as the cold air of the surgery hit the hot surface. "So," I said, reaching for the cloth he'd fetched me, and trying for as matter-of-fact a voice as could be managed, "Jane and Fanny's parents had died, and they had no way to feed themselves. So Jane became a whore. But some men are very wicked. I expect you know that already, don't you?" I added, glancing up at him, and he nodded soberly. "Yes. Well, a wicked man came to the place where Jane and Fanny lived and wanted to make Fanny go to bed with him, even though she was much too young to do such a thing. And, Jane killed him."
"Wow."
I blinked at him, but it had been said with the deepest respect. I coughed and began folding the cloth. "It was very heroic of her, yes, but she...
How did she kill him?"
"With a knife," I said, a little tersely, hoping he wouldn't ask for details. I knew them, and wished I didn't. But the man was a soldier, and when the British Army found out, they arrested Jane.
"Oh, Jesus,"
Jem said, in tones of awed horror.
"Did they hang her? Like they tried to hang Dad?"
I tried to think whether I should tell him not to take the Lord's name in vain. But on the one hand, he clearly hadn't meant it that way. And for another, I was a blackened pot in that particular regard. "They meant to. She was alone and very much afraid, and she... well, she killed herself, darling." He looked at me for a long moment, face blank, then swallowed hard.
"Did Jane go to hell, Granny?" he asked in a small voice. "Is that why Fanny's so sad?"
I'd wrapped the stone thickly in cloth. The heat of it glowed in the palms of my hands. "No, sweetheart," I said, with as much conviction as I could muster. "I'm quite sure she didn't. God would certainly understand the circumstances. No, Fanny's just missing her sister." He nodded, very sober.
"I'd miss Mandy if she killed somebody and got..."
He gulped at the thought. I was somewhat concerned to note that the notion of Mandy killing someone apparently seemed reasonable to him. But then, "I'm quite sure nothing like that would ever happen to Mandy. Here." I gave him the wrapped stone. "Be careful with it." We made our way slowly upstairs, trailing warm ginger steam, and found Jamie sitting beside Fanny on the bed, a small collection of things laid out on the quilt between them. He looked up at me, flicked an eyebrow at Jem, and then nodded at the quilt. Frances was just showing me a picture of her sister. Would you let Mrs. Fraser and Jem have a look on Ian? Fanny's face was still blotched from crying, but she had herself more or less back in hand, and she nodded soberly, moving aside a little. The small bundle of possessions she had brought with her was unrolled, revealing a pathetic little pile of items: a knit comb, the cork from a wine bottle, two neatly folded hanks of thread, one with a needle stuck through it, a paper of pins, and a few small bits of tawdry jewellery. On the quilt was a sheet of paper, much folded and worn in the creases, with a pencil drawing of a girl. "One of the men drew it one night in the salon," Fanny said, moving aside a little so we could look. It was no more than a sketch, but the artist had caught a spark of life. Jane had been lovely in outline, straight-nosed and with a delicate, ripe mouth, but there was neither flirtation nor demureness in her expression. She was looking half over her shoulder, half smiling, but with an air of mild scorn in her look.
"She's pretty, Fanny," Jemmy said, and came to stand by her.
He patted her arm as he would have patted a dog, and with as little self-consciousness. Jamie had given Fanny a handkerchief, I saw. She sniffed and blew her nose, nodding.
"This is all I have," she said,
her voice hoarse as a young toad's.
"Just this and a locket.
"This?" Jamie stirred the little pile gently with a big forefinger and withdrew a small brass oval dangling on a chain. "Is it a miniature of Jean, then? Or maybe a lock of her hair?" Fanny shook her head, taking the locket from him.
"No," she said. "It's a picture of our mother.
She slid a thumbnail into the side of the locket and flicked it open. I bent forward to look, but the miniature inside was hard to see, shadowed as it was by Jamie's body.
"May I?"
Fanny handed me the locket, and I turned to hold it close to the candle. The woman inside had dark, softly curly hair like Fanny's, and I thought I could make out a resemblance to Jane in the nose and set of the chin, though it wasn't a particularly skillful rendering. Behind me, I heard Jamie say quite casually,
"Frances, no man will ever take you against your will, while I live."
There was a startled silence, and I turned round to see Fanny staring up at him. He touched her hand very gently.
"Do you believe me, Frances?" he said quietly.
"Yes,"
she whispered after a long moment, and all the tension left her body in a sigh like the east wind. Jemmy leaned against me, head pressing my elbow, and I realized that I was just standing there, my eyes full of tears. I blotted them hastily on my sleeve and pressed the locket closed. Or tried to. It slipped in my fingers, and I saw that there was a name inscribed inside it, opposite the miniature.
"Faith," it said.
I couldn't go to sleep. I'd given Fanny her tea, provided her with suitable cloths. Not at all to my surprise, she already knew how to use them, and talked gently to her, careful not to raise any more of her personal ghosts. When Fanny had come to us, Jamie and I had agreed that we wouldn't try to question her about any of the bits of memory she dropped aloud, like the bad men on the ship, and what happened to Spotty the dog, unless she seemed to want to talk about them. I thought she would, sooner or later. Bree and Roger had agreed as well, though I could see how curious Brianna was. Fanny had mentioned Jane now and then, offhandedly, but in a way designed, I thought, to keep a sense of her sister alive. Seeing her distress tonight, though, Jane was much closer to her than I'd thought. And now that I'd seen Jane's face, I couldn't forget it. Knowing only what I did know about the girls' lives in the brothel in Philadelphia was upsetting. I really hadn't wanted to find out how they'd come there. I still didn't. But I couldn't keep the worm of speculation at bay. It had burrowed into my brain and was squirming busily through my thoughts, killing sleep. Bad men on a ship. A dog thrown into the sea. A pet dog. A family. If Fanny and Jane had been with their parents on a ship that encountered pirates, or even a wicked captain like Stephen Bonnet. I felt the hairs rise on my forearms at the thought of him, but with remembered anger, not fear. Someone like him could easily have taken a look at the two lovely young girls and decided that their parents could be dispensed with. Faith. Our mother, Fanny had said. I'd looked more than once at the miniature in the locket, but it was too small to show anything more than a young woman with dark hair, maybe naturally curly, maybe curled, and dressed in the fashion of the times. No, it can't be. I rolled over for the dozenth time, settling on my stomach and burying my face in the pillow in hopes of losing myself in the scent of clean linen and goose down.
It can't be what, Sassenach?
Jamie's voice spoke in my ear, sleepily resigned.
And if it can't, can it not wait till dawn?
I rolled onto my side in a rustle of bedding, facing him. I'm sorry, I said, and touched him apologetically. His hand took mine automatically, warm and firm. I didn't realize I'd said it out loud. I was just thinking about Fanny's locket.
Faith.
Ah, he said, and stretched himself a little, groaning.
You mean the name, Faith?
Well, yes, I mean, it can't possibly have anything to do with...
It's no an uncommon name, Sassenach.
His thumb rubbed gently over my knuckles.
Of course you'll feel it. I did too.
Did you? I said softly. I cleared my throat a little. I don't really do it any more. But for a time, just every now and then, I'd think of her, of our Faith, out of nowhere. I'd imagine I could feel her near me.
Imagine what she might look like, grown.
His voice was soft, too.
I did that sometimes. In prison, mostly. Too much time to think in the nights. Alone.
I made a small sound and hitched closer, laying my head in the curve of his shoulder, and his arm came round me. We lay still, silent, listening to the night and the house around us. Full of our family, but with one small angel hovering in the calm, sweet air, peaceful as rising smoke. The locket, I said at last. It can't possibly have anything whatever to do with...
No, it can't, he said,
a cautious note in his voice.
But what are you thinking, Sassenach? Because you're no thinking what you just said, and I ken that fine.
That was true, and a spasm of guilt at being found out tightened my body. It can't be, I said, and swallowed. It's only... My words died away, and his hand rubbed between my shoulder blades.
Well, you'd best tell me, Sassenach, he said, no matter how foolish it is. Neither one of us will sleep until you do.
Well, you know what Roger told me about the doctor he met in the Highlands and the blue light?
I do. What?
Roger asked me if I'd ever seen blue light like that when I was healing people. The hand on my back stilled.
Have you?
He sounded guarded, though I didn't know whether he was afraid of finding out something he didn't want to know, or just finding out that I was losing my mind. No, I said, or not... Well, no. But I have seen it, felt it, twice. Just a flash when Mulver's baby died.
Died in my hands, covered with his mother's blood.
But when Faith was born, when I was so ill, I was dying, really dying, I felt it, and Master Raymond came.
You told me that much, he said. Is there more?
I don't know, I said honestly, but this is what I thought happened. And I told him about seeing my bones glow blue through the flesh of my arms, the feeling of the light spreading through my body and the infection dying. leaving me limp, but whole and healing. So, I know this is nothing but pure fantasy, the sort of thing you think in the middle of the night when you can't sleep. He made a low noise, indicating that I should stop apologizing and get on with it. So I took a deep breath and did, whispering the words into his chest. Master Raymond was there. What if he found Faith and was able to somehow bring her back? Dead silence. I swallowed and went on. People aren't always dead, even though it looks like it. Look at old Mrs. Wilson. Every doctor knows or has heard about people who've been declared dead and wake up later in the morgue.
Or in a coffin.
He sounded grim, and a shudder went over me.
I have heard stories like that. But a wee babe and one born too soon, how?
I don't know how, I burst out. I said it's complete fantasy. It can't be true, but... My throat thickened, and my voice squeaked.
But you wish it were.
His hand cut the back of my head, and his voice was quiet again.
Aye. But if it was Mochia, why would he not have told you? You saw him again, no? After he'd healed you, I mean.
Yes. I shuddered, momentarily feeling the King of France's star chamber close around me, the smell of the king's perfume, of dragon's blood and wine in the air, and two men before me, awaiting my sentence of death. Yes, I know, but when the Comte died, Raymond was banished and they took him away. He couldn't have told me then, and he might not have been able to come back before we left Paris. It sounded insane, even to me, but I could just see it. Master Raymond stealing out of l'Hôpital des Anges after leaving me. Perhaps ducking aside to avoid notice, hiding in the place where the nuns had, perhaps, laid Faith on a shelf, wrapped her in swaddling clothes. He would have known her as he'd known me.
Everyone has a colour about them, he said simply, all around them like a cloud. Yours is blue, Madonna, like the Virgin's cloak, like my own.
One of his? The thought came out of nowhere, and I stiffened.
Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ,
what if? All right, I was insane, but too late for that to make a difference. What if what if Master Raymond was somehow related to me? Jamie said nothing, but I felt his hand move under my hair. His middle finger folded down, and the outer one stood up straight, making the sign of the horns against evil.
And what if he's not?
He said dryly. He rolled me off him and turned toward me, so we were face to face. The darkness was slowly fading, and I could see his face drawn with tiredness, touched with sorrow and tenderness, but still determined.
Even if everything you've made yourself think was somehow true, and it's not, Sassanach. You ken it's not. But if it were somehow true, it wouldn't make any difference. The woman in Francis's locket is dead now, and so is our Faith.
His words touched the raw place in my heart, and I nodded, tears welling.
I know,
I whispered.
I know too, he whispered,
and held me while I wept. Chapter 25.
Voulez-vous coucher avec moi?
The weather was still fine in the daytime, but the smoke shed stood in the shade of a rocky cliff. No fire had been lit in here for over a month, and the air smelled of bitter ash and the tang of old blood. How much do you think this thing weighs? Brianna put both hands on the shoulder of the enormous black and white hog lying on the crude table by the back wall, and leaned her own weight experimentally against it. The shoulder moved slightly. Rigor had long since passed, but the hog itself didn't budge an inch. At a guess, it originally weighed somewhat more than your father, maybe 400 pounds on the hoof. Jamie had bled and gralloched the hog when he killed it,
That had probably lightened his load by 100 pounds or so, but it was still a lot of meat. A pleasant thought for the winter's food, but a daunting prospect at the moment. I unrolled the pocketed cloth in which I kept my larger surgical tools. This was no job for an ordinary kitchen knife. "What do you think about the intestines?" I asked. "Usable, do you think?" She wrinkled her nose, considering. Jamie hadn't been able to carry much beyond the carcass itself, and in fact had dragged that, but had thoughtfully salvaged 20 or 30 pounds of intestine. He'd roughly stripped the contents, but 2 days in a canvas pack hadn't improved the condition of the uncleaned entrails. Not savoury to start with. I'd looked at them dubiously, but put them to soak overnight in a tub of salt water, on the off chance that the tissue hadn't broken down too far to prevent their use as sausage casing.
"I don't know, Mama," Bree said reluctantly.
"I think they're pretty far gone, but we might save some of it."
"If we can't, we can't."
I pulled up the largest of my amputation saws and checked the teeth. "We can make square sausage after all." Cased sausages were much easier to preserve. Once properly smoked, they'd last indefinitely. Sausage patties were fine, but took more careful handling and had to be packed into wooden casks or boxes in layers of lard for keeping. We hadn't any casks, but...
"Lard!" I exclaimed, looking up. "Bloody hell, I'd forgotten all about that. We don't have a big kettle, bar the kitchen cauldron, and we can't use that."
Rendering lard took several days, and the kitchen cauldron supplied at least half our cooked food, to say nothing of hot water.
"Can we borrow one?"
Bree glanced toward the door where a flicker of movement showed.
"Jem, is that you?"
"No, it's me, Auntie."
Germain stuck his head in, sniffing cautiously. "Mandy wanted to visit Rachel's petit bonbon, and Grandpère said she could go if Jem or me would take her. We threw bones, and he lost."
"Oh, fine then. Will you go up to the kitchen and fetch the bag of salt from Granny's surgery?"
"There isn't any," I said, grasping the pig by one ear and setting the saw in the crease of the neck. "There wasn't much, and we used all but a handful soaking the intestines. We'll need to borrow that, too." I dragged the saw through the first cut and was pleased to find that while the fascia between skin and muscle had begun to give way, the skin slipped a little with rough handling. The underlying flesh was still firm.
"I tell you what, Bree," I said, bearing down on the saw as I felt the teeth bite between the neck bones. "It's going to take a bit of time before I've got this skinned and jointed. Why don't you call round and see which lady might lend us her rendering kettle for a couple of days, and a 1/2 pound of salt to be going on with?"
"Right," Bree said, seizing the opportunity with obvious relief.
"What should I offer her? One of the hams?"
"Oh, no, Auntie," said Germain, quite shocked. "That's much too much for the lend of a kettle. And you shouldn't offer anyway," he added, small fair brows drawing together in a frown. "You didn't bargain a favour. She'll ken you'll give her what's right."
She gave him a look, half questioning, half amused, then glanced at me. I nodded. "I see I've been gone too long," she said lightly, and giving Germain a pat on the head, vanished on her errand. It took a bit of force, but I'd been lucky, well, skilled, let us say, in all modesty, in placing the saw, and it took only a few minutes to haggle the head off. The last strands of muscle fibre parted, and the massive head dropped the few inches to the tabletop with a thunk, limp ears quivering from the impact. I picked it up, estimating the weight at something like 30 pounds, but of course that included the tongue and jowls. I'd take those before setting the head to seethe for brawn. That could be done overnight, though, in the kitchen kettle. I must set the oatmeal to cook the night before, then I could warm the porridge in the ashes, or perhaps fry it with some dried apples. I was sweating lightly from the work, a welcome relief from the chill. I got the feet off, tossed them into a small bucket to be pickled, then set aside the saw and chose the large knife with the serrated blade. Even untanned, pig hide was tough. I was breathing heavily by the time I'd got the carcass half flayed, and pausing to wipe my face on my apron, I lowered it
to discover that Germain was still there, sitting on a cask of salt fish Jamie had got in trade from George Feinbeck, one of the Moravians from Salem. "This isn't a spectator sport, you know," I said, and motioned him to come and help. "Here, take this." I gave him one of the smaller knives, and pull back on the skin. You don't really need to cut much, just use the blade to push the skin away from the body.
"I can how, Granny," he said patiently, taking the knife. "It's the same as skinning a squirrel, only bigger."
"To a point, yes," I said, taking his wrist to readjust his aim. "But a squirrel, you're skinning all of a piece for the pelt. We need to take the hog's hide off in pieces, but make sure the pieces are big enough to be useful. You can make a pair of shoes from the leather off one haunch." I traced the line of the cuts round the haunch down the inside of the leg and left him to it whilst I negotiated the forequarters. We worked in silence for a few minutes, silence being rather uncharacteristic of Germain, but I thought him absorbed in his task. And then he stopped. "Granny," he began, and something in his voice made me stop too. I actually looked at him for the first time since he'd come in, and I set down my knife.
"Do you ken what voulez-vous coucher avec moi means?" he blurted.
His face had been white and strained, but flooded with colour at this, making it fairly evident that he knew. "Yes," I said, as calmly as possible. "Did someone say that to you, sweetheart?" "Who?" I wondered. I hadn't heard of a French speaker anywhere in miles of the ridge. And one who might...
"Well, funny," he blurted again, and went purple.
He was still holding his skinning knife, and his small knuckles were white from gripping it.
"Funny?" I thought, stunned.
"Really?" I said carefully. Reaching out slowly, I took the knife from his hand and set it down next to the half-flayed hog. "It's a bit close in here. Let's go outside for a breath of air, shall we?" I didn't realize just how oppressive the atmosphere in the smoke shed was until we stepped out into a whirl of wind, fresh and full of yellow leaves. I heard Germain take a deep gasping breath and breathed deep too. In spite of what he just told me, I felt a bit better. So did he. His face had gone back to something near its normal color, though still pink in the ears. I smiled at him, and he smiled uncertainly back. "Let's go up to the spring house," I said, turning toward the path. "I fancy a cup of cold milk, and I dare say Grandad would like some cheese with his supper." "So," I went on casually, leading the way up the path, "where were you and Fanny when she happened to say that to you?"
"Down by the creek, Granny," he said readily enough. "She got leeches on her legs, and I was pulling them off for her."
Well, that's quite the romantic setting, I thought, but didn't say, envisioning Fanny sitting on a rock with her skirts hiked up, long coltish legs white and leech-spattered.
"See,"
he went on, and came up beside me, now anxious to explain.
"I was teaching her le français. She wants to learn it, so I was telling her the words for leech and waterweed, and how to say things like, 'Give me food, please,' or 'Go away, you wicked sod.'"
"How do you say 'go away, you wicked sod'?" I asked, diverted.
"Va-t'en, espèce de méchant," he said, shrugging.
"I'll remember that," I said. "Never know when it might come in handy." He didn't respond. Plainly, the matter occupying his mind was too serious for diversion. He'd been badly shocked, I saw. "How did you happen to know what voulez-vous coucher means, Germain?" I asked curiously. "Did Fanny tell you?" He hunched his shoulders and blew out his cheeks like a bullfrog, then shook his head, letting his breath go.
"No, Papa said it to Maman one night, while she was cooking supper, and she laughed and said something I didn't quite hear."
He looked away, so I asked Papa next day, and he told me. "I see." He probably had, and very directly. Fergus had been born and grown up in a Paris brothel to the age of 9, when Jamie had inadvertently collected him. He dealt with his past by being honest about it, and I didn't suppose it would have occurred to him to evade his children's questions, no matter what they asked. We'd reached the new spring house, a squat little stone-built structure straddling a likewise stone-lined ditch through which the water from the house spring flowed. Buckets of milk and crocks of butter were sunk in the water, keeping cold, and wrapped cheeses sat quietly hardening on a shelf above, out of the reach of occasional muskrats. It was dim inside and very cold. Our breath wisped out when we stepped inside. I took down the gourd dipper from its nail, squatted, and took the lid off the bucket that held the morning's milk. I stirred it to mix the risen cream back in, drew a dipperful and drank. It was cold enough to feel it sliding down my gullet, and delicious. I took a last swallow and handed Germain the dipper. "Do you think Fanny knew what she was saying?" I asked, watching him as he squatted to draw his own milk. He didn't look up, but he nodded, the top of his fair head bobbing over the dipper. "Aye," he said at last, and stood up, turning away from me as he reached up to hang the dipper on its nail. "Aye, she kent what it meant. She touched me when she said it." Dim as it was, I could see the back of his neck darken. "And what did you say?" I asked, hoping I sounded entirely calm. He swung round and glared at me as though it was somehow my fault. He had a moustache of cream, absurdly touching. "I said, I warn Balder Haid. What else?" "What indeed?" I said lightly. "I'll talk to Grandpère about it."
"You're not going to tell him what Fanny said to me, are you? I didn't mean to get her in bother."
"She's not in trouble," I assured him. Not the sort he meant, at least. "I just want your grandfather's opinion about something. Now, cut along." I made a shooing gesture at him. "I have a hog to deal with." By contrast with what he'd just told me, 300 pounds of pork chops, lard, and rotting intestines seemed trivial. Chapter 26. In the Scuppernongs. Brianna pulled a handful of grapes off their stems and rolled them with one finger, flicking away any that were split, withered, or badly gnawed by insects. Speaking of insects, she hastily blew several ants that had crawled out of her grapes off the palm of her hand. They were tiny, but fierce biters. Ow! She'd missed one of the little buggers, and it had just bitten her in the web between her middle and ring fingers. She tossed the grapes into her bucket and rubbed her hand hard on her breeches, momentarily easing the burn.
"Gushalag shilevaram,"
Amy said at the same moment, dropping a handful of grapes and shaking her hand. "There's hundreds of the wee buggers in these scuppernongs." "They weren't nearly as bad as yesterday," Bree said, trying to rasp the ant bite between her fingers with her front teeth. The itch was maddening. "What's brought them out, I wonder?"
"Oh, it's the rain," Amy said. "It always brings them up from the Jesus, Mary and Bride."
She backed away from the vine, shaking her skirts and stamping her feet. "Get off me, you wicked wee blatherskites." "Let's move," Brianna suggested. "There are a ton of grapes out here. The ants can't be in all of them."
"I don't ken so much about that," Amy muttered darkly,
but she picked up her bucket and followed Brianna a little further into the small gorge. Bree hadn't been exaggerating. The rocky wall was thick with muscular vines that clung and writhed up into the sun, heavy with pearly bronze fruit that gleamed under the dark leaves and perfumed the air with the scent of new wine. "Jem," she shouted, "we're moving. Keep track of Mandy." A faint, "Okay," came from above. The kids were playing at the top of the rocky cleft, where a stream had split the stones and left small outcrops studded with vines and saplings that made fine castles and forts.
"Watch for snakes," she shouted. "Don't get under the vines up there." "I know."
A red-headed form appeared briefly above, brandished a stick at her, and disappeared. She smiled and bent to pick up her buckets, one satisfyingly heavy, the other half-filled. Amy made a sudden whoosh of startlement, and Brianna turned. Amy wasn't there. The grapevine swayed against the cliff face, and she saw a dark splash on the rock.
What?
She said, registering the sharp smell of blood and reaching blindly for the first thing to hand, the half-filled bucket. A flash of white, Amy's petticoat. She lay on the ground 10 feet away. There was blood on her clothes, and a bear had her head in its mouth, making a low gargling noise as it worried at her. Brianna flung the bucket in reflex. It hit the cliff face and fell, scattering bronze grapes over Amy and the ground. The bear looked up, blood on its teeth, and growled, and Brianna was scrambling up through the vine, shrieking at the children to get back, get away, run! Branches cracking beneath her weight, giving way. One broke and she slipped and fell, hit the ground on her knees, scrabbled back, away, away, God, God! Staggered to her feet and leapt for the vines again, sheer terror for the kids, driving her up the rock in a shower of leaves and crushed grapes and bits of earth and rock and ants. Mom! Mom! Jem and Germain were leaning far out from the edge, trying to catch hold of her to help. Get back! She gasped, clinging to the rock. She risked a glance below and wished she hadn't. Jem, get back! Get Mandy, get the others back, now! Too late to stop them seeing. There was a chorus of screams and a crowd of small, horror-stricken faces at the top of the cliff face. Mama! Mama! It was that word that got her the rest of the way, torn and bleeding. At the top of the cliff she crawled, grabbing wailing children, pulling them back, gathering them into her arms, counting. How many? How many should there be? Jem, Mandy, Germain, Ori, little Rob. Aiden, she gasped. Where's Aiden? Jem looked at her, white-faced and wordless, turned his head to look. Aiden was at the top of the cliff, starting to let himself down into the vines to get to his mother. Aiden, Germain shouted. Don't! Bree shoved the other children at Jem. Keep them, she said, breathless, and lunged after Aiden, catching him by the arm just as he vanished over the edge. She hauled him up by main force and clutched him hard against her, struggling and weeping.
I got to go. I got to get Mam. Let go. Let me go.
His tears were hot on her skin, and his skinny body writhed like a snake, like the rusty grapevines, like the biting ants.
No,
she said, hearing her own voice only faintly through the roaring in her ears.
No.
And held him tight. I was showing Fanny how to use the microscope, reveling in her shocked delight at the worlds within. Though in some instances it was plain shock, as when she discovered what was swimming in our drinking water. Don't worry, I assured her. Most of them are quite harmless, and your stomach acid will dissolve them. Mind, there are nasty things in water sometimes, particularly if it's had excrement in it. Shit, I mean, I added, seeing her lips silently frame excrement. Then the rest of what I'd said struck her, and her eyes went round.
Acid,
she said, and looked down, clutching her midsection.
In my stomach?
Well, yes, I said, careful not to laugh. She had a sense of humour, but was still very tentative in this new life, and feared being laughed at or made fun of. It's how you digest your food.
But it's...
She stopped, frowning.
It's strong acid. It eats right through things.
She'd gone pale under the light tan the mountain sun had given her. Yes, I said, eyeing her. Your stomach has very thick walls, though, and they're covered in mucus, so...
My stomach is full of snot.
She sounded so horrified that I had to bite my tongue and turn away for a moment, under the pretext of fetching a clean slide. Well, you find mucus pretty much all over the insides of your body, I said, having got control of my face. You have what are called mucous membranes and serous membranes. Those secrete mucus wherever you need a bit of slipperiness.
Oh.
Her face went blank, and then she looked down below her clutching hands.
Is that what you have between your legs, to make you slippery when...
Yes. I said hastily. And when you're pregnant, the slipperiness helps the baby come out. Here, let me show you.
I'd told Jamie what she'd said to Germain. He'd raised his eyebrows briefly and then shaken his head. Little wonder, given where she's been, he said. Let it bide. She's a canny wee lass. She'll find her way.
I was drawing pictures of goblet cells on the back pages of my black book when I heard rapid footsteps on the porch, and an instant later Jem skidded into the surgery, wild-eyed and white-faced.
Mrs. Higgins, he gasped, she got killed by a bear. Mam's bringing her.
Killed, I said automatically, and then,
what?
Fanny uttered a tiny, wordless scream and threw her apron over her head. Jem's knees gave way and he sat down on the floor with a thump, panting. I heard voices outside in the distance, urgent, and grabbing my emergency kit, I ran to see what was happening. Brianna had evidently met Jamie on her way. He had Amy Higgins in his arms, bringing her down the hill as fast as he could manage, Bree stumbling behind him, moving like a drunk. All three of them were covered in blood.
Oh, Jesus, I said,
and ran up the hill to meet them. There was a lot of noise. Children were everywhere, crying and wailing, and Bree was trying to explain, chest heaving for air, and Jamie was asking sharp questions. He saw me, and at my frantic gesture, squatted and laid Amy on the ground. I fell to my knees beside her, seeing the tiny rhythmic spurt of blood from a severed vessel in her temple. She's not dead, I said, and pulled rolls of bandages and handfuls of lint out of my pack. Yet.
I'll fetch Bobby, Jamie said quietly in my ear. Brianna, see to the wains, eh?
First stop the bleeding. And the best of British luck to you, I added grimly, and silently, to myself. A good portion of the left side of her face had simply been torn away. The scalp was lacerated. One eye had been gouged from its socket, the orbit and cheekbone splintered, and the white bone of the broken jaw exposed, seeping blood welling up around the remaining scarlet-stained teeth and dribbling down the side of her neck. She lay oddly, crookedly, and I realized that her left shoulder had been crushed. Her dark green bodice and sleeve were black, sodden with blood. I whipped a tourniquet around the upper arm, feeling the broken ends of bone grate as I moved it. Pressed a towel as gently as I could to the shattered side of her face, and saw the cloth darken at once, soaked through. And with a sense of utter futility, I pressed my thumb against the tiny spurting artery in her temple. It stopped. I looked up and saw Mandy, dead white and shocked into silence, clinging fiercely to little Rob, who was whimpering and struggling, trying to get to his mother. She was still alive. I could feel the tremor of her flesh under my hands. But so much was lost. So much blood, so much trauma, so much shock, that I knew she'd lose her grip soon. And with that realization, I made the shift. I couldn't heal her. All I could do now was stay with her and try to ease her. She was making a soft coughing noise and bubbles of blood appeared at the visible corner of her mouth. One hand rose in the air, searching vainly for something to hold on to. Roger ran across the grass, fell to his knees on the other side of her body, and grasped the drifting hand.
Amy, he said, short of breath. Amy, Bobby's coming. I hear him. He's almost here.
Her eyelid lifted, shivered shut against the light, opened cautiously in just a crack.
Mummy? Mama? Ma'am?
The shrieks of her children came thin and piercing, and her ruined mouth twitched and fell open, struggling to answer them.
Stay with me. Ori! Aiden! Aiden, no!
Bree was kneeling on the grass, clutching Aiden by the wrist as he fought to go to his mother. Little Ori, terrified, clinging to Bree's hunting shirt. The blood wasn't spurting anymore. It was spreading fast and silent, soaking the ground. My hands were red to the wrist.
Amy! Amy!
Bobby, wild-eyed, charging up the slope, Jamie behind him. He stumbled and half fell to his knees, chest heaving for air. Roger grabbed his hand and put Amy's in it.
No, Bobby said, fighting for breath. No.
Amy,
don't
Please don't go, please. I saw her fingers twitch, move, tighten on his for an instant. No more.
Jesus, Rogers said. Oh, God.
He looked at me for a moment and read everything in my face. He lifted his head and looked across to Bree and the children, and I saw his face change in sudden decision.
Bring them, he said, raising his voice enough to be heard over the crying and shouting. Quick!
Brianna shook her head briefly, her eyes fixed on the ruin of Amy's face.
Should the boys remember their mother like that? Bring them, Roger said louder. Now!
She gave a small, jerky nod and let go of Aidan, who dashed to his mother and fell on the ground beside Bobby, clinging to him and sobbing. Bree came after him, holding Ori and Rob by their hands, tears sheeting all their faces. Roger took the little boys, held them in his arms close to their mother.
Amy, he said through the sobbing, your sons are with you. And Bobby?
He hesitated, looking at me, but at my nod let go of Ori and laid his hand gently on her chest.
Lord God, be merciful unto us, he whispered. Be merciful. Hold her in the palm of thy hand. Keep her always in the hearts of her children.
Amy moved. Her head turned a little toward the boys, and she opened her one eye, slowly, so slowly as though it was an effort equal to lifting the world. Her mouth twitched once, and then she died. Chapter 27. Cover her face.
There was no time for delicacy. The men had brought Amy's body down to the house and at my direction laid her on the table in my surgery. The day was hot, and she was still very warm to the touch. But her body had a disconcerting inert heaviness like a burlap bag filled with wet sand. Rigor would soon be separating her from the soft elasticity of life. I'd have to undress her before she got too stiff. But first, I covered her face with a linen towel. There was time for that much delicacy, I thought. I was glad I'd taken the time, too, when I turned at the sound of a step on the threshold and saw Bree, still in her blood-stained hunting shirt, her face much whiter than the old sheet folded over her arm. I nodded at the counter behind me.
Put that down and go sit with the children outside in the sun, I said firmly. They need someone to hold them. Where's Roger?
She shook her head, unable to take her eyes off the table. Amy's fichu had been pulled halfway out of her bodice and was hanging down, soaked with rapidly drying blood that left faint smears on the table. I pulled the cloth loose and dropped it into the bucket of cold water at my feet.
Roger's with Bobby, she said, her voice colourless.
Fanny's minding Mandy and the little boys for a minute. You'll need help, won't you? With... She broke off and swallowed audibly, looking away.
Someone will be here soon, I said, and took a little comfort in the thought.
I was familiar with death, but that didn't mean I'd got used to it. Your father sent Germain running for young Ian. Rachel and Jenny will come down too. And Jem's gone for Jilly McMillan. His wife will gather up the women who live along the creek. She nodded, seeming a little calmer, though her hands were still trembling, the folded sheet bunched between them.
Why is Dar sending for Mr. McMillan? She asked.
He has two good hunting dogs, I said evenly, and a boar spear.
Holy Lord! They're going to hunt the bear now?
Well, yes, I said mildly, before it gets too far away. Where's Aidan? I added, realizing that she'd said the little boys. Aidan was 12, but still qualified in my book. Did he go with Jem?
No, she said, her voice sounding odd. He's with Dar.
Aidan was white as milk, and he kept blinking his swollen red eyes, though he'd stopped greeting. He hadn't stopped shaking. Jamie put a hand on the lad's shoulder and could feel the tremble coming up from the earth through Aidan's flesh.
I'm coming,
Aidan said, though his chin wobbled so much you could hardly understand him.
To hunt the bear.
Of course you are.
Jamie squeezed the fragile shoulder and after a moment's hesitation let go and turned toward the house.
"Come with me, Avalach," he said. "We'll need to fettle ourselves before we go out."
Every instinct he had was for avoiding the house where Claire and the women would be laying Amy out. But he'd been younger than Aidan was now when his own mother died, and he remembered the desolation of being shut out, sent away from the house, while the women opened the windows and doors, covered the mirror, and went purposefully about with bowls of water and herbs, completing the secret rituals of taking his mother away from him. Besides, he thought bleakly, glancing down at the blanched wee lad stumbling along beside him, the boy had seen his mother dying in her blood little more than an hour ago, her face torn half away. Nothing he might see or hear now would be worse. They stopped at the well, and Jamie made Aidan drink cold water and wash his face and hands, and Jamie did likewise, and said the beginning of the consecration of the chase for him.
"In the name of the Holy Threefold as one, in word, in deed, and in thought, I am bathing my own hands in the light and in the elements of the sky, vowing that I shall never return in my life without fishing, without fowling either, without game, without venison down from the hill, without fat, without blubber from out the copse."
Aidan was breathing hard from the shock of the cold water, but he could talk again.
"Bears have fat," he said.
"Aye, and we will take it from him."
Jamie scooped water in his hand, and dipping three fingers into the puddle in his palm, made the sign of the cross on Aidan's forehead, breast, and shoulders.
"Life be in my speech, sense in what I say, the bloom of cherries on my lips till I come back again. Traversing corries, traversing forests, traversing valleys long and wild. The fair white Mary still uphold me, the shepherd Jesu be my shield." "Say that last bit with me, lad."
Aidan drew himself up a little and piped along.
"The fair white Mary still uphold me, the shepherd Jesu be my shield."
"Well then."
Jamie pulled out his shirt tail and wiped Aidan's face and his own.
"Will you have heard that prayer before?"
Aidan shook his head. Jamie hadn't thought he would. Aidan's real father, Orrin McCullum, might have taught him. But Bobby Higgins was an Englishman, and while a good man in himself, he wouldn't know the old ways. As though the thought had conjured him, Aidan asked seriously,
"Will Daddy Bobby come with us to hunt the bear?"
Jamie sincerely hoped not. Bobby had been a soldier, but was no hunter, and in his grief and distraction might easily get himself or someone else killed. And there were the little lads to think of. But he said,
"If he feels he must, then he shall. But I hope he will not."
Roger had taken Bobby, looking completely destroyed, back to the Higgins cabin. He set the bucket on the well coping and laid a hand on Aidan's shoulder again. It was firmer now, and the bairn's chin had stopped quivering.
"Come on, then," he said. "We'll fetch my rifle and set things in order. Ian Oag and Mr. Macmillan will be here soon."
"Go," I said to Bree, but more gently. I came and took the sheet that she was still clutching, set it down, and put my arms around her.
"I understand," I said quietly. "She's your friend, and you want to do what you still can do for her. And you don't know why it's her lying there, and you standing here, still alive, and everything's come apart at the seams."
She made a small sound of assent and caught her breath in a sob. She clung tight to me for a moment, then let go. Tears were trembling on her lashes, but she was holding on to herself now, not me.
"Tell me what to do," she said, straightening up. "I have to do something."
"Take care of Amy's children," I said. "That's what she'd want you to do, above all things." She nodded, pressing her lips together in determination, but then glanced at the still figure on the table, smelling of urine, feces, and the thick reek of torn flesh. Flies were beginning to come through the window. They flew in lazy circles, scenting opportunity, seeking a place to lay their eggs. On the body. It wasn't Amy anymore, and the flies had come to lay claim to her. Brianna was nearly as good as Jamie at hiding her feelings when she had to, but she wasn't hiding anything now, and I saw the fear and anguish underneath the shock. She couldn't bear to deal with Amy's shattered body, and so had come to do so. Fraser, I thought, moved by her bravery as much as by her grief. I picked up the other towel and slapped it on the counter, killing two flies that had been unwary enough to land near me. Someone will come, I repeated. Go. Take Fanny with you. Chapter 28 McGowan. Ian, not surprisingly, appeared first, walking in through the open front door. Jamie heard the soft tread of his moccasins a moment before Ian spoke to Claire in the surgery. There was a brief exclamation of shock. Germain would have told him what was to do, but not even a mohawk would be unmoved by the sight of Amy Higgins's body. And then his voice dropped in a murmur of respect before the soft tread came on toward the kitchen. "That'll be Ian," Jamie said to Aidan, who was very slowly and painstakingly filling cartridges on the kitchen table, tongue sticking out the side of his mouth as he poured gunpowder from Jamie's flask. He stopped at Jamie's words, looking toward the door. Ian didn't disappoint the lad. He was carrying his own long rifle with shot pouch and cartridge box, but had also brought a very large and wicked-looking knife thrust through his belt unsheathed, and had a strung bow and a birch-bark quiver over his shoulder. He was shirtless, in buckskin leggings and loincloth, but had taken a moment to say his own prayers and apply his hunting paint. His forehead was red above the eyebrows, and a thick white stripe ran down the bridge of his nose, with another on each side running from cheekbone to jaw. White, he'd told Jamie, was for vengeance, or to commemorate the dead. Aidan, who knew Ian quite well in his Scottish person, had never seen him in purely mohawk form before. He made a small woof noise, awed. Jamie hid a smile, picking up his own dirk and the oilstone on which to sharpen it. "Ah, Ian," he said, suddenly noting his nephew's bare chest. "Do you maybe ken where my claw's gone? The bear claw the Tuscarora gave me, I mean." He hadn't thought of the thing in years. He'd lent it to Ian some time back to wear on a hunting trip, but it maybe wouldn't be a bad thing to have with him just now, if it was handy.
"Aye, I do."
Ian had sat down to fold up Aidan's cartridges, quick and neat, and didn't look up.
"I gave it to my cousin William."
Oh. He considered Ian, who still didn't look up. "And when was this?"
"Ach, some time ago," Ian said airily. "When I got him out of the swamp, Ken, I told him you wanted him to have it."
He did glance up then, one thin eyebrow raised, just like his father.
"I was no wrong, was I?"
"No," Jamie said, feeling a sudden warmth, though the hairs prickled on his neck.
"No, you weren't."
Bluebell, who'd been nosing round the back door, suddenly turned and shot toward the front of the house, barking. A chorus of deep-voiced baying answered her from the bottom of the slope before the house.
"That'll be Gilbride, then," Jamie said, and sheathed his dirk. "Are we fettled, lads?"
I'd got Amy's stays off, and her skirt. The skirt wasn't torn. It would do, with washing. Amy had no daughter who might use it, but there was always need of clothes and cloth. Someone on the ridge would welcome it. I put it aside to wash later. The stays were badly torn at the shoulder and stiff with blood. I put them to the other side. I'd salvaged the tin ribs, then put the fabric in the fire. The shift. That was torn too, though it might be mended or used for patching or quilting. I couldn't see her buried in it, though. It was bloody and befouled. She had on only one light petticoat and her stockings.
Wash those, then, and...
I heard the baying of Gilbride's dogs in the near distance, and the thunder of Bluebell's feet as she raced down the hall to meet them. They should be all right together. The Macmillan dogs were both male. Bluey was a female, and not in heat, and as Jamie had told me in a wry moment, dogs don't bite bitches.
"Doesn't it always work the other way round, mind?" he'd said,
and I didn't quite smile at the memory, but felt the air press less heavily on me for a moment. Then I heard a step in the hallway and looked up, thinking it was Gilbride. It wasn't, and the air suddenly thickened in my chest.
"Mrs. Fraser."
It was the tall, black figure of Mrs. Cunningham, bony and stern as the Grim Reaper, with a folded cloth over one arm. She hovered awkwardly on the threshold, and I just as awkwardly motioned her in. "Mrs. Cunningham," I said, and stopped, not knowing what the hell else to say to her. She cleared her throat, glanced at Amy's half-clad corpse, then quickly away. Even though the head was covered, the mangled arm and shoulder were in plain sight, cracked and shattered bones showing sharp through the still flesh. "I was by the creek. Your grandson passed me on his way to Macmillan's and told me what was ado. So I went along to Mr. Higgins and asked for his wife's shroud." She lifted the cloth slightly in illustration, and I saw the embroidered edges done in greens, blues, and pinks.
Oh!
That Amy would have her shroud already prepared hadn't occurred to me at all. Though it should have. Thank you, Mrs. Cunningham. That was very thoughtful of you. She lifted one shoulder in a faint shrug, and taking a visibly deep breath, walked up to the table. She looked the situation over deliberately for a moment, exhaled through her nose, then reached to untie the ribbon of Amy's shift. "If you hold her steady, I'll roll it down." I opened my mouth to protest that I didn't need help, but then shut it again. I did, and plainly she'd had some experience of laying out the dead. Any woman of her age would. We rolled the shift off Amy's shoulder, and I got one hand solidly into the bare right oxter, the damp hair there feeling disconcertingly warm and alive, and then, with an uncontrollable sense of squirm, threaded my fingers under the wet mess of the left shoulder, finding enough to grip. So close, the odour of the bear on her was strong enough that I felt an atavistic shiver down my spine. Mrs. Cunningham did too. She was breathing audibly through her mouth. She got the petticoat untied, though, and pulled shift and stockings off with steady hands. "Well, then," she said, and looking round saw that I'd put the skirt aside to wash and added the rest of the clothes to the pile. "When the other women come, we'll have them launder those at once," she said, in the tone of one accustomed to give orders and have them obeyed. "We'll not want the smell of..." "Yes," I said, with a perceptible edge that made her glance sharply at me. "Right now, we'll need to clean her up. Will you go into the kitchen and fetch a bucket of hot water? I'll tear that up," nodding at the worn, thin sheet Brianna had brought, "for binding strips." She compressed her lips, but in a way that suggested grim amusement at my feeble attempt to exert authority rather than offence, and left without a word. There was a good bit of barking out front, and I heard Gilbride, his name meant oyster catcher, he told me, calling to the dogs. I ripped the worn sheet into wide bands. We'd fasten her legs together and her arms at her side, insofar as was possible. I eyed the left shoulder dubiously, cloth binding her body into seamliness before we braided her hair and put her into her shroud. Mrs. Cunningham reappeared with her sleeves rolled up, a bucket of steaming water from the cauldron in one hand, and a hammer in the other, a quilt from my bed over her arm. "There'll be men coming to and fro in a moment's time," she said, with a jerk of her head toward the hallway. "Ah," I said. I would have closed the surgery door, save that there wasn't one yet. She nodded, set down the bucket, took a handful of tenpenny nails from her pocket, and hung the quilt over the open doorway with a few sharp raps of the hammer. There was plenty of light coming in at the big window, but the quilt seemed somehow to muffle both light and sound, casting the room into something like a state of reverence, despite the growing noises outside. I took a handful of dried lavender and rubbed it into the hot water, then tore sweet basil leaves and mint and tossed them in as well. To my slight surprise, Mrs. Cunningham looked over the jars on my shelves, took down the salt, and threw a small handful into the water. "To wash away sin," she informed me crisply, seeing my look, "and keep her ghost from walking." I nodded mechanically at this, feeling as though she'd dropped a pebble into the small pool of calmness I was hoarding, sending ripples of uneasiness through me. We managed the cleansing and binding of the body in silence. She moved with a sure touch, and we worked surprisingly well together, each conscious of the other's movements, reaching to do what was needed without being asked. Then we reached the head. I took a breath through my mouth and lifted the towel away. There were blood spots on it, and it stuck a bit. Mrs. Cunningham jerked a little. "I was thinking that we might just keep her head covered," I said apologetically. "With a clean cloth, I mean." Mrs. Cunningham was frowning at Amy's face, the wrinkles in her upper lip drawn in like an accordion. "Can you not do a bit to tidy her?" "Well, I can stitch what's left of the scalp back in place, and we could pull some of her hair over the missing ear. But there's nothing I can do about The dislodged eyeball hung grotesquely on the crushed cheek, its surface filmed over, but still very much a staring eye. "That's why I thought, cover her face." Mrs. Cunningham's head moved slowly side to side. "Nay," she said softly, her own eyes fixed on Amy. "I've buried 3 husbands and 4 bairns myself. You always want to look upon their faces one last time, no matter what's happened to them." "Frank." I'd looked at him and said my last goodbye, and was glad that I'd had the chance. I nodded and reached for my surgical scissors. "Germain told me where the bear came upon them," Ian said. "I went along there quick on my way down, and I could see where it had gone through the vines, out the end of the wee gorge. We'll start there, aye?" Jamie and Macmillan nodded, and Macmillan turned to say something reproving to his dogs, who were sniffing industriously from one end of the kitchen to the other, thrusting their broad heads into the hearth and nosing the lidded slop bucket. "Speaking of Germain," Jamie said, suddenly aware that his grandson was missing, "where the devil is he?" It was completely unlike Germain to be absent from any interesting situation. He was much more often right in the middle of it. "Did he go with you to look for the bear's track?" Jamie asked sharply, interrupting Gilbride's recriminations. Ian looked blank for a moment, recollecting, but then nodded. "Aye, he did, but I was sure he was just behind me as I came down." He turned involuntarily and glanced behind him now, as though expecting Germain to spring up through the floorboards. With a deep foreboding in his heart, Jamie swung round to face Gilbride. "Did Jem come back with you, Gilly?" Macmillan, a tall, soft-spoken man, took off his head and scratched his bald pate. "Aye," he said slowly, "I suppose so. He ran ahead, though, while I was gathering the dogs. Didn't I see him again?" Jamie made the horns against the devil and crossed himself hurriedly. "Christ between us and evil! Let's go!" How old was Mrs. Cunningham, I wondered. She looked older with her clothes on. 3 husbands, 4 children. But death was a casual and frequent visitor in these days. Her hands were old, with thick blue veins and knobbed joints, but still agile. She blotted the blood away with a damp cloth, brushed the soft brown hair from the intact side of Amy's skull, and arranging it carefully to hide as much damage as she could, braided it into a single thick plait that she laid gently on Amy's breast. I'd taken care of the eye. It was sitting on the counter behind me. I'd wrap it discreetly and tuck it into the shroud, and insert a small wad of lint into the crushed socket, stitching the lid shut over it. There was no concealing that Amy had died by violence, but at least her family would still be able to look at her. "Mrs. Do you mind if I call you by your Christian name?" I asked abruptly. She glanced up from her contemplation of the corpse, slightly started. "Elspeth," she said. "Claire," I said, and smiled at her. I thought a smile touched her own lips, but before I could be sure, the quilt hanging over the doorway twitched violently, and one of Gilbride's big bear dogs shouldered his way in, sniffing eagerly along the floor. "And what do you think you're doing?" I asked. The dog ignored me and made a beeline for the counter, where he rose gracefully onto his hind legs, gulped the eye, and then dropped and ran out in answer to his master's annoyed call from the hallway. Elspeth and I stood in frozen silence as the hunting party departed noisily through the front door, the dogs yelping in happy excitement. As the house fell quiet, Elspeth blinked. She looked down at Amy, peaceful and composed in the embroidered shroud she had woven while expecting her first child. It was edged with a trailing vine, with pink and blue flowers and yellow bees.
"I will," she said at last. "I dinna suppose it matters so much whether a person's eaten by worms or by dogs."
She sounded dubious, though, and I suppressed a sudden insane urge to laugh.
"Being eaten by dogs is in the Bible," I said instead.
"Jezebel." She raised one sparse grey brow in surprise, evidently at the unexpected revelation that I'd actually read the Bible, but then nodded.
"Well, then," she said.
Jamie's sense of grim urgency was growing more urgent. It was mid-afternoon already, but there was one more thing that had to be done. He had to tell Bobby Higgins what they were about and hope that the man was either too shattered to insist on coming or wise enough not to, and convince him that it was right for Aidan to go. He should have paused to scoop up the wee boys. They were the best reason for Bobby to stay put, but he hadn't thought of it in time. His anxiety was eased a good bit by the sight of Jem loitering outside the Higgins cabin. His relief at finding the lad, though, was immediately tempered by Jem's impassioned desire to join the hunting party.
"If Aidan can go," Jem said
for roughly the fourth time, chin jutting out. Jamie bent down and grabbed him by the arm, speaking low so as not to upset Aidan.
"Your mother wasn't eaten by a bear, and she'll no be pleased if you are. You're staying."
"Then Aidan shouldn't go. His dad won't like it if he gets eaten, will he?"
That was a thought that had been gnawing at Jamie, but he didn't repent allowing the boy to come.
"His mother was eaten by a bear, and he's the right to come and see her avenged," he said to Jem.
He let go of the lad's arm, took him by the shoulder, and turned him toward the cabin.
"Go get your da. I want to talk to him."
The other members of the hunting party were restive, and he told Ian to go on ahead with Gilbride and the dogs, see if they could get upon Germain's track. Aidan looked wild, still, white-faced, his black hair stood on end, and Jamie took hold of him again to quiet him.
"Stay by me, Aidan. We will never be more than a minute, but we must tell your da what's ado."
It was much less than a minute before Roger came out of the cabin, blinking in the sunlight, with Jem behind him looking excited but solemn. Roger Mack bore the same traces of shock that they all did, though he had himself well in hand, and his face relaxed a little, seeing Jamie. Then it tightened again as he saw the rifle.
"We are."
He motioned the boys firmly away and dropped his voice.
"I need to tell Bobby, but I dinna want him to come. Will you help me talk him round?" "Of course, but..."
He glanced toward Aidan and Jimmy, slouched at the side of the cabin.
"You're not taking them." "I will not take Jim if you say no. That's yours to say. But I think Aidan must come."
Roger gave him a look of intense scepticism, and Jamie shrugged.
"He must,"
he repeated stubbornly. All the reasons why not were clustering like flies round his head. But the remembered sense of an orphaned boy's helpless despair was an iron splinter in his heart, and that weighed heavier than the rest. The fire had gone out, in the cabin, and in Bobby, too. He sat hunched and sagging in the corner of the settle by his cold hearth, head bent over his open hands as though he sought some meaning in the lines on his palms. He didn't look up when they came in. Jamie sank down on one knee and laid his hand over Bobby's. It was cold and flaccid, but the fingers twitched a little.
"Robert Harwich,
he said quietly.
I am going now to hunt the bear. With God's help, we will find it and kill it. Aidan wishes to come with us, and I think it is right that he should.
Bobby's head rose with a jerk.
Aidan? You want to take Aidan after the bear that...
I do.
Jamie took hold of Bobby's other hand and squeezed them.
I swear on my own grandson's head that I will not let any harm come to him.
You mean Jem? You're taking him as well? Confusion showed briefly through the deadness in Bobby's eyes, and he looked over Jamie's shoulder at Roger Mack.
He is?
Aye.
Roger Mack's voice broke on the word, but he said it, bless him. Inspiration blossomed in Jamie's mind, and with an inward prayer he rolled his dice.
Roger Mack will come as well, he said, hoping he sounded completely sure of it. He'll mind both lads and see them safe.
He could feel Roger Mack's eyes burning a hole in the back of his head, but he was sure it was the right thing.
Blessed Michael, guide my tongue.
My nephew, Ian, and Gilbride Macmillan will be with me, with dogs. The three of us and three dogs will have the upper hand of a bear, no matter how fierce. Roger Mack and the lads will be there only to bear witness for your wife. At a safe distance, he added.
Bobby sat up, pulling his hands free, and looked to and fro, agitated.
But I should go with you then, shouldn't I?
Roger, recognizing his cue, cleared his throat.
Your wee lads need you, Bobby, he said gently. You've got to mind them, You're all they've got left.
Jamie felt those words strike suddenly and without warning deep in his own wame. Felt again a bundle of cloth clutched hard against his breast, feeling the tiny pushings of the hours-old babe inside, himself shaking with terror at what he had just done to save the boy. His son. That's what he thought. The only thought that came through the haze of fear and shock.
His mother's dead. I'm all he has.
And he saw it happen for Bobby as it had for him. Saw the life fight its way back into his eyes, the bones of his body melted with grief begin to stiffen and form again. Bobby nodded, lips pressed tight together. Tears still ran down his face, but he rose from the settle, slow as an old man, but moving.
Where are they? He asked hoarsely. Ori and Rob?
With my daughter, Jamie said, at the house.
He lifted a brow at Roger Mack, who gave him an old-fashioned look, but nodded.
I'll go up with you, Bobby, Roger Mack said.
And to Jamie,
I'll catch you up, you and the lads.
The women were coming. I could hear their voices faint in the distance, coming up from the creek. That would be Gilbride's wife with her eldest daughter, Kirsty, and Peggy Chisholm, who lived nearby with her two eldest, Mari and Agnes, and Peggy's ancient mother-in-law, Old Mum, who was not right in the head and therefore couldn't be left alone. Then there were nearer female voices and steps in the hall, and Fanny came in, solemn-faced with Rachel and Jenny. She glanced at the quilt-hung doorway and then averted her eyes. I let out my breath at sight of them, and with it the sense of being keyed up to meet something dreadful that had been with me since Jem had stumbled breathless into the surgery to tell me what had happened. Jenny put down her basket, hugged me quick and hard, then ducked without a word beneath the hanging quilt into the surgery. Rachel had a basket too, and Oggie in her other arm. She detached the baby and handed him to Fanny, who looked relieved to be given something to do.
"Is he all right, Claire?" she asked softly, then glanced at Mrs. Cunningham, who had taken up a station beside the covered surgery door, hands folded at her waist.
"Andy, friend Cunningham?"
"Yes," I said.
The odd sense of being in an intimate bubble with Elspeth Cunningham had burst at once with the advent of friends and family, but the experience had left me feeling oddly moist and exposed, like a half-opened clam. Elspeth herself had closed her shell tightly, but nodded to the new arrivals. Her own near neighbours would be coming down as soon as the news reached them, but it would take some time.
The Crombies and Wilson's several cabins were at least 2 miles from us. Jenny was praying softly in Gaelic. I couldn't catch the words clearly enough to know what she said, but the distinctive lilt of mourning was in it.
"Come aside," Rachel said softly to me, and drew back the quilt a little, beckoning me with a sober nod of the head that simultaneously summoned me and indicated that no one else need follow.
Jenny had just finished her prayer. She put out a hand and rested it very gently for a moment on Amy's white-capped head. She said quietly, "May the peace of the Blessed Mother and of her Son Jesus be on you, daughter." Rachel looked at Amy's body and swallowed, but didn't flinch or look away.
"Germaine said it was a bear," she said,
and I saw her eyes slide toward the pitiful pile of tattered, blood-stained garments.
"Was the present Claire?"
"No. Brianna was with her when it happened, picking grapes. Some of the children were there, too. Jemmy, Jemma, and Aidan. The little boys and Mandy."
"Dear God! Did they see it?" Rachel asked, shocked.
I shook my head. "They were up above playing. Bree and Amy were picking muskets in that little gorge beyond the creek. She, Brianna, got the children away and then ran for Jamie. She, Amy, was just barely alive when I got to her." My throat tightened, seeing the small, pale hand limp in Roger's, the twitch at the corner of her mouth as she tried to bid her children farewell. Despite my determination, a small hot tear slid down my cheek. Rachel made a small sound of distress and smoothed my hair away from my cheek. Jenny cleared her throat, reached into her pocket, and handed me a clean handkerchief. "Well, the front door was open when we came in," Jenny said, ticking off a mental checklist. She glanced at the huge, glassless surgery window open to the day. "And you'll not need to open the windows." This tinge of dry humour, small though it was, relieved the tension, and I felt a small crack between my shoulder blades as my spine relaxed for what seemed the first time in days, not hours. "No," I said. I blotted the tears and sniffed. "What else? Mirrors? There's only the hand glass in my bedroom, and it's already lying face down." "No birds in the house. I see you've got salt." A few grains had spilled on the counter when Elspeth had thrown salt into the water. "And bread will na be a worry." She cocked her still black eyebrow in the direction of the kitchen. I could hear the voices of women as they greeted new arrivals, unpacked baskets, made things ready. I wondered if I should go and organize things, tell them where to place the coffin. Ought it to be in the front room or in the much bigger kitchen? Oh, God, a coffin! I hadn't even thought of that. "Oh," said Jenny, in a different voice, "here's Bobby a-coming up the hill with Roger Mack." As one, we all glanced at Amy's body, then looked at one another, questioning. We had made her as seemly as we could, but could we leave Bobby alone with her? That didn't seem right, but neither did a crowd of women likely to set each other off if one burst into tears.
"I'll stay with him," Rachel said, swallowing.
Jenny glanced at me, eyebrow raised, then nodded. Rachel had a gift for stillness. "I'll mind our wee man," Jenny said, and kissing Rachel affectionately on the forehead, went out. Elspeth Cunningham had already vanished, presumably to help the women now murmuring in the kitchen, busy but subdued, the sound of them like termites working in the walls of the house. I waited with Rachel to receive Bobby, mentally compiling a list. There was a full cask of whiskey and a half-empty one in the pantry, but no beer. Caitlin Breuer might bring some. I should send Jem and Germain up to ask, and perhaps Roger would go speak to Tom MacLeod about the coffin. Footsteps in the hall, and the sound of choked breathing. Bobby appeared in the doorway, but to my surprise it was Brianna, not Roger, supporting him. She looked nearly as destroyed as Bobby did, but had her arm firmly round his shoulders. She was 4 inches taller than he was, and despite her obvious distress, stood solid as a rock.
Amy, he said, seeing the white shroud, and her name was no more than an anguished breath. Oh, my God, Amy. He looked at me in red-eyed appeal and silent despair. How could I have let her die?
Nothing could have saved her, and we both knew it, but I felt the sting of helplessness and guilt nonetheless.
Bobby began to cry, in the awful, wrenching way that men do. Brianna had been pale and blotchy with grief and shock. Now she flushed, her own eyes welling. Rachel moved near my shoulder, and the next thing I knew, she'd taken Bobby from Bree as easily as she might have accepted a fresh egg in her hand, careful of him, but calm. "Let us sit with thy wife for a bit," she said softly, and guided him to a stool. She cast a quick look over her shoulder at Brianna and nodded to me before sitting down beside Bobby. I walked Bree out of the surgery and straight out of the house, thinking that she wouldn't want the other women to see her so distraught. I must give her something for the shock, I thought, but before I could suggest anything, she turned and gripped me by the elbow, wet eyes blazing through her tears. "Dar's gone," she said, "and he's taken Roger and Jem and Aidan with him to hunt that bloody bear." "Oh, aye," Jenny said behind me before I could speak. She laid a hand on Brianna's arm and squeezed. "Dinna fash, lass. Jamie's a hard man to kill, and Ian's painted his face. And I said the blessing for them both, the one for a warrior going out. They'll be fine." Roger caught up with Jamie and the two boys. He was glad to see that they'd met Germain along the way, just short of the opening to the small gorge where the grapevines grew in abundance. They'd heard him crashing along, and they'd paused to wait for him. He stopped, breathing heavily, and nodded toward the rocky wall where the vines rippled and quivered in the light breeze.
"This is where it happened."
The smell of ripe muscats was strong and sweet above the rough, bitter smell of the leaves, and his stomach growled in response. He hadn't eaten since breakfast. Jamie reached into his sporran and handed him half a crumbling bannock without comment.
"Father on, Dad," Jamie said. "We were over there, up on top of the cliff. Mam and Mrs. Higgins were down below. See where that big shadow is? That's where..."
He broke off abruptly, stared, then shrieked, "The bear! The bear! There it is!" Roger dropped the bannock and his staff and seized Jemmy by one arm and Aidan by the collar, dragging them back. Jamie and Ian didn't move. They looked down the length of the gorge, looked at each other, then shook their heads.
"Dinna fash, Avalach," Jamie said to Aidan kindly. "It's no the bear."
"You're sure of that, aren't you?"
Roger felt as though the breath had been knocked out of him. He could see what Jemmy had seen. A small growth of hemlocks on the left rim of the gorge cast deep shadows over the vines on the right, and something was moving in that shadow.
"Foxes,"
Ian said, with a one-shouldered shrug. "Come to... ah." He broke off, noticing Aidan, who was breathing like a steam engine.
"Sanguinem culum lingere," Jamie said tersely. "Well, come to me and Ian."
All the dogs were interested in the foxes, tugging at their leashes and whining, but not barking.
"To lick the blood."
Roger's mind made the Latin translation and rapidly readjusted itself to events, presenting him with a stomach-dropping sense of what had happened here only a few hours ago. Jamie was talking to Ian and Gilbride in Gaelic now, gesturing along the ridge. Jem and Aidan clustered close to Roger, silent and big-eyed. The breeze had changed direction, and he heard the squealing and barks of the foxes.
"Did you see what happened to Mrs. Higgins?"
Roger asked Jem, low-voiced. Jem shook his head.
"Mandy did," he said. "Mam came up the grapevines and got us. Like Tarzan," he added.
"Like what?"
Ian had picked that up and turned to look down at Jem, puzzled. Roger made a dismissive gesture, and Ian turned back to the discussion. This lasted no more than a few moments, and they set off along the edge of the gorge, the dogs sniffing eagerly to and fro. Chapter 29.
Remember, man.
Go, her mother had said firmly. You need to move, and someone needs to go and tell Tom MacLeod that we'll be needing a coffin as soon as possible.
Her mother cast a quick haunted glance back into the house. If we can have it by tonight for the wake.
So soon, Brianna had thought. She was numbed by the shocks of the day, but this was a fresh one. She was only a few hours ago.
Her mother sighed, nodding.
I know, but it's still warm out.
Flies, Mrs. Cunningham added baldly.
She had come to the door, presumably looking for Claire. She nodded bleakly at Brianna.
I've been 2 weeks in hot weather where there were maggots dropping from the shroud and wriggling across the floor. At least if there's a coffin, they...
We'll put her body in the spring house for now, her mother said hastily with a reproachful look at Elspeth Cunningham.
It will be all right.
Go, darling.
She went. Tom MacLeod boasted that he was the only coffin maker between the Cherokee line and Salem. Whether this was true, Brianna didn't know, but as he told her, he did usually have at least one coffin a building, in case of sudden need.
This one's near finished, he said,
leading Brianna into an open-sided shed smelling of the fresh wood shavings that covered the floor.
Higgins, you see. Not sure I know which lady that might be. How big would you say?
Brianna mutely held a hand at the level of her chest, and Mr. MacLeod nodded. He was old, leathery, and mostly bald, with a half-sprouted grey beard and shoulders stooped by constant bending over his work. But he exuded a sense of calm competence.
This'll do, then. Now, as to when...
He squinted at the half-finished coffin, balanced on wooden sawhorses. Pine planks in different stages of preparation leaned against the walls. She could hear the rustle of what were probably mice in the shadows, and found it oddly soothing, almost domestic.
I could help you, she blurted,
and he looked up at her, startled.
I'm a good builder, she said.
There were tools hanging on one wall, and she stepped across and took down a plane, holding it with the confidence of one who knows what to do with it. He saw that, and blinked slowly, considering. Then his eyes passed slowly up her body, taking in her height and her blood-stained clothes.
You're himself, lass, are you not? He said,
and nodded, as though to himself.
Aye, well, if you can drive a nail straight, fine. Otherwise, you can sand wood.
Roger said a silent prayer as they passed through the gorge. One for the soul of Amy Higgins, and on its heels, another for the safety of the hunting party. The boys walked soberly, keeping near him as they'd been told to, glancing to and fro as though expecting the bear to leap out of the grapevines. Perhaps a half hour later, the walls of the gorge spread apart and flattened into forest, and they walked into the shadow of tall pines and poplars, the dogs shuffling shoulder-deep in the fallen leaves and dry needles, forging the way. Ian was in the lead. He stopped at the bottom of a steep slope and nodded to the other men, pointing upward.
Is the bear up there?
Aidan whispered to Roger.
I don't know.
Roger took a firmer grip on his staff. He had a knife on his belt, but it wouldn't begin to penetrate the hide and fat of a bear.
The dogs do, Germain observed.
They did. One of the bear hounds threw up his head and made a deep, eager baying sound and lunged forward.
Gilbride loosed him at once, and he shot up the slope into the trees, followed by Bluebell and the other hound, the three of them, swift as water, calling as they went. And they were all running then, the dogs and the men after them, as fast as they could through the crunching leaves. Roger's chest began to burn, and he could hear the boys gulping air and panting, but they kept up. All the dogs had the scent and were baying with excitement, long tails waving stiff behind them. Ian and Jamie were swarming up the slope, long-legged, hurdling fallen logs and dodging trees. Gilbride was labouring alongside Roger, now and then finding enough breath for shouting encouragement to the dogs. Roger didn't know which man had shouted.
Jamie and Ian were well out of sight, but the Gaelic words rang faintly through the trees.
There, there it is. Aidan made a high choking noise, put his head down, and began to run as though his life depended on it, ploughing his way up the slope.
Roger grabbed Jamie's hand and followed with Germain, jabbing his staff hard into the ground to help them along. They crested the slope, lost their balance, and slid and tumbled down into a small dell where the dogs were leaping like flames around a tall tree, yammering and howling at a very large, dark shape, 30 feet off the ground, wedged in the crotch between two trunks. Roger scrambled to his feet, shedding dry leaves, and looking for the boys. Aidan was nearby. He'd got halfway up and was frozen on his hands and knees looking up. His mouth moved, but he wasn't talking. Roger looked round wildly for Jemmy.
Jem, where are you?
Right here, da,
Jem said from behind him through the noise of the dogs.
Is Aidan okay?
He felt a thump of relief at sight of Jem's red head. His plait had come undone, and his hair was full of pine needles. There was a scrape on his cheek, but he clearly wasn't hurt. Roger patted him briefly and turned to Aidan, crouching down beside the boy.
Aidan, are you all right?
Aye.
He seemed dazed, and no wonder. He'd not taken his eyes off the bear.
Will it come down and eat us?
Roger gave the bear in the tree a wary look. It bloody well might, for all he knew.
Himself and the others ken what to do, he assured Aidan, rubbing the boy's small bony back in reassurance.
He hoped he was right.
If it comes for you, hit it across the snout as hard as you can, Jamie had told him. If it makes to bite, drive your stick down its throat.
He'd lost his staff, tumbling down. Where?
There.
He scrambled down the slope, keeping an eye on the bear, a solid black blob against the blue sky. It didn't seem disposed to move, but he felt much better with a stick in his hand. The hunters had gathered together a little way off and were regarding the bear, narrow-eyed. The dogs were ecstatic, leaping, clawing the tree, barking and yelping, and plainly willing to keep doing it for as long as it took.
Come on.
Roger gathered the boys and led them up the slope, behind Jamie and the others. Now that he'd got them safely in hand, he had a moment to actually look at the bear. It was moving its head restively from side to side, peering down at the dogs and clearly thinking, what the hell? He was surprised to feel a sense of sympathy for the treed animal. Then he remembered Amy, and sympathy died.
Can I get a decent shot?
Jamie was saying, sighting along his rifle. He lowered it and glanced at Ian.
Can you move him for me?
Oh, aye.
Ian unslung his bow, unhurried, and with no fuss at all, knocked an arrow and shot it straight into the bear's backside. The bear squealed with rage and backed rapidly halfway down the trunk, gave the dogs a quick glance, and then with an amazing grace jumped to another tree 10 feet away, grabbing the trunk. The men all shouted, and the dogs instantly swarmed the new tree, just as the bear started down. The bear, the arrow sticking absurdly out behind it, went back up, looked to and fro for a better idea, and not finding one, jumped back to its original tree. Jamie shot it, and it thumped to the ground like a huge sack of flour.
Crap, said Jamie, awed.
Germain grabbed his hand. Aidan gave a howl of rage and lunged toward the fallen bear. Roger lunged too and grabbed Aidan's collar, but the worn shirt ripped, and Aidan ran, leaving a handful of cloth in Roger's grasp.
Fucking stay there!
Roger shouted at Jem, who was staring open-mouthed, and went after Aidan, crashing through fallen branches and twisting his ankles and scraping his shins on stumps and deadfalls. The other men were all shouting and running too, but Aidan had got the knife from his belt and was roaring in a high treble as he stumbled the last few feet toward the bear. The dogs had already reached it and were snapping and tearing at the carcass, if it was a carcass. Gilbride was belting down the slope, spear in both hands, and bellowing at the dogs. The bear rose suddenly, swaying, and swatted Bluebell away. She crashed against a tree with a yelp and fell, and Aidan stabbed his little knife into the bear's side,
screaming and screaming. And then Roger had him, grabbed him round the middle and flung himself away with Aidan beneath him, and heard behind him the thunk of the spear and a long, long sigh from the bear. Leaves flew up as the bear hit the ground. They touched Roger's face, and one of the dogs galloped across him, its nails digging into his back as it launched itself at the dead bear.
"Pat? Dad? Are you okay?"
Jemmy was pulling at him, yelling. He dimly heard Gilbride and Ian beating the dogs away from the carcass, and felt a big, hard hand under his elbow, pulling him upright, and the forest spun.
"The dog's all right," Jamie was saying,
and Roger wondered whether he must have asked without realizing it, or whether Jamie was just making conversation.
"She's maybe cracked a rib, nay more. The wee lad's fine, too," he added. "Here."
He took a small flask from his sporran and wrapped Roger's hands around it.
"Daddy?"
Jem was kneeling by him, anxious. Roger smiled at him, though his face felt like melted rubber, unable to hold its shape for more than a few seconds.
"It's all right, Avalach."
The strong smell of the bear mingled with the scent of whiskey and dead leaves. He could hear Aidan sobbing and looked for him. Ian had him, an arm round the boy, cuddled against his side as they sat in the yellow leaves against a fallen log. He saw that Ian had thumbed some of the white paint mixed with bear fat from his own face and streaked it across Aidan's forehead. Jamie and Gilbride were by the bear, examining it, Germain peeking cautiously from behind his grandfather. With a great effort, Roger got to his feet and held out a hand to Jem.
"Come on."
It was a beautiful thing, in spite of the wounds. The softness of its muzzle, the colours of the body, and the perfect vivid curves of claws, pads, huge rounded back, brought him close to tears. Jamie knelt by the bear's head and lifted it, the heavy skull moving easily as he turned it and thumbed the lip away from the big teeth, fingers moving along the jaw. He grimaced, and reaching gingerly into the bear's maw, drew out a tiny scrap from between the back teeth, something that looked like a fragment of some plant, something dark green. He spread out his palm and touched the thing, spreading it open, and Roger saw that it was a scrap of dark green homespun, tinged black at one edge. The wet black seeped out onto Jamie's palm, and Roger could see that it was blood. Jamie nodded, as though to himself, and tucked the fragment of Amy's bodice into his sporran. Then he stood, with a definite intent of body that made Ian stand up too, leading Aidan to come and stand with them all, while Jamie said the prayer for the soul of one fallen in battle. They came down to the big house at sunset, Brianna and Tom MacLeod carrying the coffin between them, he at the head and she at the foot. She watched the back of his head as they negotiated their way through the long tree shadows, and wondered how old he might be. His hair was thin and mostly white, tied back in a wisp, and his skin scaly and brown as a turtle's. But his eyes were bright and fierce as a turtle's too, and his broad hands knew wood. They hadn't exchanged more than a dozen words during the afternoon, but they hadn't needed to. At first, she'd felt deep sorrow at thought of a coffin, Amy being buried, put away, separated. But her soul had settled in the work, fear, shock and worry fading with the concentration needed in the handling of sharp objects, and she'd begun to feel a sense of peace. This was a thing she could do for Amy, lay her to rest in clean wood. Her hands were rough now with sanding, and her clothes full of sawdust. She smelled of sweat and fresh pine, and the balsam firs perfumed the coffin trail. Incense, she thought. It was nearly dark by the time Brianna left Tom and the coffin in the yard and went upstairs to make a hasty toilet and change her clothes. They fell off, heavy with sweat and sawdust, and she felt a moment's relief as though she'd shed some small part of the day's burden. She pushed the discarded clothes into a corner with her foot
and stood still, naked. The house below hummed like her mother's beehive, with intermittent bangs and callings out as people came through the open door, the voices instantly hushing in respect, but only momentarily. She closed her eyes and ran her hands very slowly over her body, feeling skin and bone, the soft swing of the damp, heavy hair that hung down her back, unbraided. She thought she should feel guilty. She did feel guilty, through the fog of exhaustion. But as her mother had said more than once, the flesh has no conscience. Her body was grateful to find itself alive in a cool, dark room, being soothed and sponged and combed by candlelight. A soft knock at the door, and Roger came in. She dropped the petticoat she'd been about to put on and went to him in her shift and stays.
"What did you do with the bear?"
she mumbled into his shoulder some minutes later. He smelled of blood.
"Gralloched it, put ropes on it and dragged it home. I think your da put it in the root cellar to keep things from getting at it. He says he and Gilly McMillan will skin and butcher it tomorrow. It'll be a lot of meat," he added.
A faint shudder went down her back and into her belly. He felt it and hugged her closer.
"You okay?"
he said softly into her hair. She nodded, unable to speak, and they stood together in silence, listening to the subdued rumble of the house below. "Are you okay?" she asked, at last letting go. She stepped back to look at him. His eyes looked bruised with tiredness, and he'd just shaved. His face was damp and blotched from scraping, and there was a small cut just below his jaw, a dark line of dried blood.
Was it awful? Aye, it was. But really wonderful, too.
He shook his head and stooped to pick up the fallen petticoat.
I'll tell you later. I've got to put on my gear and go speak to people.
He straightened his shoulders as he spoke. She could see him reach beyond his own emotion and tiredness and grasp his calling as another man might grip his sword. Later, she echoed, and thought fleetingly that maybe she should learn the words of the blessing for a warrior going out. It took her some time to pull herself together enough to leave the sanctuary of her bedroom and go down. Amy's coffin had been placed on trestles in the kitchen, as the crowd come to wake her would never fit into the small parlour. Everyone brought food. Rachel and the two eldest Chisholm girls had taken charge of unpacking the baskets and bags and laying things out. Brianna drew in a hesitant breath as she entered the room, making her stays creak. But it was all right. If there was any smell of bear or decay, it was masked by the scents of burning firewood, candle wax, berry jam, apple cider, cheese, bread, cold meat, and beer, with a comforting ghost of her father's whiskey floating through the crowd. Roger was by the hearth, dressed in his black broadcloth with the minister's high white neckcloth, greeting people quietly, clasping their hands, offering calm and comfort. He caught Brianna's eye and gave her a warm look, but was engaged with old Mam, who stood on tiptoe, balancing with her hand on his arm, shouting something into his ear. She glanced at the coffin. She must go and pay her respects, find a few words to say to Bobby.
Yeah, like what? I can't just say, I'm so sorry.
Tears had come to her eyes just looking at him. The bereaved husband was making a valiant effort to keep upright and to respond to a rush of sympathy that threatened to swamp him. Her father had taken up a station standing beside Bobby, keeping an eye on him, fielding the more exigent outpourings, and keeping Bobby's cup topped up. He sensed Brianna's gaze on him and looked toward her, caught her eye, and lifted one heavy brow in an expression that said clear as day,
"Are you all right, lass?"
She nodded and made her best effort at a smile, but a sense of panic was rising in her, and she turned abruptly and made her way out into the hall, breathing fast and shallow. As she made her way down the chilly hallway, she seemed to hear a slow, heavy tread behind her and the scrape of claws on wood. Her mother had told her that the smaller children had been fed and put to bed in the surgery, safe behind the hanging quilt. Brianna paused, listening, and even though all was quiet within, she pulled back the edge of the quilt and looked into the room. Small bodies were curled and sprawled in cozy heaps under the big table, beside the hearth, though the fire had been smoured, and the fire screen brought in from the kitchen to prevent accidents, and in every corner of the room, sleeping on and under their parents' outer garments and their own. She saw Mandy in one pile, limbs spread like a starfish. Jem would be somewhere else, out with the older boys. The whole room seemed to breathe with the deep, slow rhythms of sleep, and she longed suddenly to lie down beside them and abandon consciousness. She glanced for the dozenth time at the big window. That had an Indian trade blanket tacked over it to keep out cold draughts. The hair lifted on her nape, looking at it. It wouldn't keep out any of the things that walked at night.
"It's all right, Wee. I'm here."
The soft voice startled her, and she jerked back, looking round. The voice had come from the corner by the hearth, and peering into the shadows, she made out Fanny, sitting cross-legged, Bluebell on the floor beside her, sound asleep, the dog's muzzle laid on Fanny's thigh, the muslin bandages round Bluey's ribs, a soft white patch in the dark. "Are you all right, Fanny?" Bree whispered back. "Do you want anything to eat?" Fanny shook her head, neat white cap like a mushroom poking through soil.
"Mrs. Fraser brought me supper. I said Bluey and me would stay with Orrie and Rob," she said, careful with her R's, "if they wake up."
"Not likely," Bree said, smiling despite her disquiet.
"But you can come get me if they do."
A little of the sleeping children's peace stayed with her as she left the surgery, but it vanished the moment she stepped back into the kitchen, hot and teeming with people. Her stays felt suddenly tighter, and she lingered by the wall, trying to remember how to breathe from the lower abdomen.
"Does Bobby own his cabin?"
Moira Talbot was asking, her eyes fixed speculatively on the little knot of people surrounding Bobby Higgins.
"Himself built it, and I ken his lass and her man dwelt there for a time, but Joseph Weems told Andrew Baldwin as how himself had given Bobby and Amy the place, but he didn't he say it was the house and land by deed, or only the use of it?"
"Dinna ken," Peggy Chisholm replied, her own eyes narrowing in speculation. She glanced toward the far side of the room where her two daughters were helping to cut and lay out slices of a vast fruitcake soaked in whiskey that Mandy MacLeod had brought down.
"Do you think maybe himself is in mind to wed his wee orphan lass to Bobby, though? If it was her, he'd see Bobby right for the cabin, sure."
"Too young," said Sophia Macmillan, shaking her head. "She's but a maid yet."
"Aye, and he needs a mother for his wee lads," Annie Babcock put in dismissively. "That one couldn't say boo to a goose. Now, there's my cousin Martina. She's 17, and..."
"Even so, the man's a murderer,"
Peggy interrupted. "I dinna think I want him for a son-in-law, even with a good hoose." Brianna, stifled by amazement, found her voice at this.
"Bobby's not a murderer," she said,
and was surprised to hear how hoarse she was. She cleared her throat hard and repeated,
"He's not a murderer. He was a soldier, and he shot someone during a riot in Boston."
A small jolt ran through her at the word Boston. The old state house behind her and the smell of traffic, with the big round bronze plaque set into the asphalt at her feet. Her fifth-grade classmates clustered around it, all shivering in the wind off the harbour. "The Boston Massacre," the plate read. "A riot," she said more firmly. "A big group of people attacked a small group of soldiers. Bobby shot someone to save the soldiers' lives."
"Why?" said Sarah McBowen, with a sceptical arch of her brow. "So why is it he's got yon M on his face, then?"
The scar had faded in the 10 years since, but was clearly visible now. Bobby sat by the coffin, and the pale glow of the candle showed the mark of the brand dark against the whiteness of his face. She saw that he was still gripping the edge of the pine coffin, as though he could keep Amy from going from him, refusing to acknowledge that she was already gone. Brianna had to go to him, had to look at Amy, had to apologize. "Excuse me," she said abruptly, and pushed past Moira. A small group of Bobby's friends were clustered about him, murmuring gruff words and giving him an occasional consoling squeeze of the shoulder. She hung back, awaiting an opening, her heartbeat thumping in her ears.
"Oh, Brianna!"
A hand clutched her arm, and Ruthie MacLeod leaned in to peer at her.
"Are ye all right, Ian? They're saying as how you were with Amy when the wicked beast took her. Is it so?"
"Yes," she said. Her lips felt stiff.
"What happened?"
Beag Moore and another young woman were clustering behind Ruthie, eyes bright with curiosity.
"How close were you to the bear?"
As though the word bear had been a signal, heads turned toward Brianna. "As close as I am to you right now," she said. She could barely hear her own words. Her heart had speeded up, and, oh, God! It burst into a violent flutter in her chest, as though a flock of sparrows were trapped inside her, and black spots swam at the edges of her sight. She couldn't breathe.
I have to...
She made a helpless gesture at the avid faces, turned and lurched out of the room, half running for the stairs. She was pulling at her bodice as she reached the landing and all but ripped it off as she stumbled into the bedroom and pushed the door closed behind her.
She had to get out of the stays. She couldn't breathe.
She tore the straps off her shoulders and squirmed out of a half-fastened corset, gasping for air, threw off her skirt and petticoat, and leaned against the wall, heart still galloping.
Air!
Sweating and trembling, she flung open the door and started up the stairs to the open air of the unfinished attic. Roger saw Brianna go white, then turn and stumble out of the kitchen, knocking into the propped-open door so it swung heavily shut behind her. He made his way through the crowd as fast as he could, but she was gone when he pushed out into the hall. Maybe she just needed air. God knew he did. The night-chilled breeze rushing in from the yard was a huge relief.
"Bree,"
he called from the doorstep, but there was no answer, only the shuffle and murmur of visitors making their way up the slope by the flickering of a pine torch.
The surgery, then. She must have gone to look at the children.
He found her, finally, in the house, high up in the open air, clinging to one of the uprights of the timbers framing the unfinished attic. A white shadow against the night sky. She must have heard him, though he tried to tread lightly. Only a single layer of boards served for the moment as both the ceiling of the second floor and the floor of the attic. She didn't move, though, save for the flow of her hair and her shift, both rippling in the unsettled air. There was a late thunderstorm in the neighbourhood. He could see a mass of steely cloud boiling up behind the distant mountain, shot with constant vivid cracks of lightning. The smell of ozone was strong on the wind.
"You look like the figurehead of a ship,"
he said, coming close behind her. He put his arms gently round her, covering her from the chill.
"You feel like one, too. You're so cold. You're hard as wood."
She made a sound that he took as an indication that she was glad to see him and acknowledged his feeble joke, but either was too cold to talk or didn't know what to say.
"Nobody knows what to say when something like this happens," he said,
and his lips brushed a cold, white ear.
"You do? You did?"
"Nah," he said.
"I said something, aye, but God knows, and I mean that, by the way, whether it was the right thing to say, or if anything ever could be in a situation like that."
"You were there," he said, in a softer voice. "You got help. You took care of the bairns. You couldn't have done more."
"I know." She turned to